Good morning. So last time we got more into congestion control, and we saw that our scheme is kind of based on looking for packet loss. So this meant that kind of our assumption in building these schemes was that all of our losses were from congestion, from queues being full. And that's not always the case, and when it's not the case, well, the schemes we learned about actually do very poorly. That basically the rate of non-congestion losses limits our bandwidth, and pretty heavily, in fact. And this is a reason why, if you look at things like Wi-Fi, they have put a lot of effort into reducing the packet loss rate, even beyond what you might think is necessary to, achieve acceptable performance, because with congestion control, the, sort of a 1% loss rate is totally unacceptable. Even though, that's something that our fast retransmission, can recover from pretty efficiently. Not, as efficiently as Wi-Fi can, but pretty efficiently. We also looked at kind of fairness. So we were concerned about, sharing our connections with multiple flows. And we learned that AIMD, we have this kind of theoretical argument that it should give us fair sharing. And in fact, when we run things in practice, we do see this, but only when the sort of our two connections are kind of equally situated. But we do see it, you might say, well, of course we see it. We're doing the same thing. We could easily imagine scenarios where, whoever, is slightly faster than someone else, gets all the bandwidth. And it's easy to accidentally construct systems that meet that if you don't do something like AIMD. But AIMD, in fact, achieves that idea where if our two connections have basically the same round trip time and the same additive increase policy, they end up with equal share of the bandwidth, effectively, or as close to equal. And we looked at, what does fairness mean when we have a situation where we can't just say you get equal shares? Like, for example, you have a slow link to the somewhere, what does it mean to allocate that fairly if we can't give you an equal share? That's literally impossible. And we have this notion of sort of min-max fairness. Which said that, something is fair if we look at someone who gets a poor allocation, that we can't make their allocation better without hurting someone who has an even poorer allocation than them. If we can make their allocation better, only hurting people who have a better allocation than them already, then it's not fair. That's what min-max fairness says. We also briefly mentioned sort of a numerical fairness measure, which was Jange Fairness Index, which you can look up the formula when you need it, but this is kind of just a numerical measure based on kind of how close to equal our shares are in a particular way that's commonly used, and how way we might evaluate, if I have 100 connections and I know what bandwidth they get, is that actually fair or not? Because it's not going to be exactly equal. There's random stuff going on a typical network. It's not going to be. And after looking at fairness, we learned that, AIMD, when all those connections are equal, it's fair, but there's real scenarios in practice where it's unfair. And one big one was with different round trip times, that our additive increase assumption was that we increased by a fixed amount. But that fixed amount was in window size. And window size kind of means different things for different connections depending on what their round trip time is. If we have a higher round trip time, a window size increase of 1 is less bandwidth we're increasing by than if we have a lower round trip time. And when they designed TCP, they didn't think about this. So the window size increase doesn't take that into account. And that means that if you have a higher round trip time, you get less bandwidth in sort of the equilibrium, the scenario we end up with kind of naturally. And this is one of the things that sort of more modern ideas at congestion control have been fighting against. We also learned that there's some variations on congestion control where we like try to fix the additive increase to like handle like really fast connections. And that ends up being unfair in like more aggressive ways. That they've tried to make it not too bad. Well, I guess most people doing this work have tried to make it not too bad for normal TCP, but often, you know, it's unfair if you look at what bandwidth it gets. So then we looked at some other kind of optimizations for TCP. And to introduce them, we had this idea that I call self-clocking, that, you know, our window size is meant to give us the number of packets in flight. And when we started congestion control, we mentioned, you know, that was going to be a good approximation, that the window size equals the packets in flight. But in fact, it's not exact. And a reason it's not exact is that things go, when we have like duplicate acts, we have losses, we lose things from the network, and there's fewer packets in flight. But we can think of kind of our normal case is that we receive a packet, we send a packet. And this is what I call self-clocking, that we're sort of naturally keeping things full. We just have to deal with the case, what about when a packet is lost? So we can apply this idea to cases where packet is lost, and that when we detect a loss, we can say, well, that gives us permission to send an additional packet, because the network is underutilized at the moment. And we saw this idea applied to fast retransmit. So we learned we wanted to retransmit when we saw duplicate acts, but a thing we added on top of that is we said, well, when we see duplicate acts, we know we've sent less than what our window size says we should send. We can temporarily sort of pretend our window size is a little higher to account for that difference. And this is in fact something should be implementations to. And then we looked at sort of setting things up at the beginning. So we mentioned that additive increase was really slow. And we did see one solution, which was this cubic idea where, you know, we just have a faster additive increase at the places where we think it's going to be useful. But we ultimately want to have a, you know, quick at the beginning of the connection. We don't know anything. We want to quickly find out what our bandwidth is. And the strategy that they come up with pretty early on in making congestion control was this idea of slow start, which is, I think, one of the worst names they've chosen. But they chose the name because the normal scheme, they just started at a random window size, and that window size might be too big. And if that window size was too big, horrible things happened. It was super, super slow. So instead, we're going to start at a window size of 1. Well, that makes sense. But the problem is that the window size 1 is totally unusable as far as how fast we get to a good window size. So what they do to compensate for that is they do this exponential increase. The way they phrase it is they increase the packet. Every time you receive a packet in slow start, you increase the window size by 1 packet. This ultimately gives us kind of a, you know, power of 2 sort of per round trip time increase. So we get an exponential increase. And if we just kept doing this, this would be horrible for our network. We'd overload all our queues. The reason it's not horrible is that immediately when we get to the point where we have a packet loss, we stop doing this mode. And we record where we were, basically, and remember only to do it up to that point later on. So questions about things we covered last time? So I think it's probably worth talking about a couple things on the quiz. So first, on the question 1 on the quiz, we had this scenario where I told you what we were reserving at the receiver, and I asked, well, how many packets are in flight after all this happens? And looking at the scenario in the receiver, we have a bunch of duplicate acts for packet 6. And my guess as to what that meant is that packet 7 was lost on the way from the sender to the receiver. We also accepted answers assuming it was reordered, but I think lost is probably the best guess. That's the most natural guess. And we know that in this scenario, we receive an ACK for 4 and we send 12. And that indicates to me that packets 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11 were all sent and not acknowledged yet. And our window size is large enough that we can fit another packet in there. And so I say initially, my guess is that we have packet 4, 5, 6, not 7, because we know 7 was lost, 8, 9, 10, and 11 in sight. We acknowledge 4, so 4 is not in flight. And I guess something I should mention here is when I say these numbers here, this is data or ACK with this number. Number in flight. So I'm not actually figuring out is the data packet in flight or is the acknowledgement in flight. I'm just saying one of those two is on the network somewhere. I'm just counting the total packets on the network regardless of which direction they're going. So we acknowledge 4. There's no longer acknowledgement for 4 going on the network. We send 12. Now 12 is going on the network. And I'm just going to say 12 is on the network. I'm not going to say whether it's the data or the ACK. At some point, the ACK gets sent in this process. We don't know because we're at the sender. We're not at the receiver. And then we acknowledge 5. So 5 is not in flight. We acknowledge 6. So 6 is not in flight. And my assumption here is that when we acknowledge 6 the second time, what happened probably is that they received the next normal packet that wasn't 7. If they received 7, they would acknowledge 7. So that's probably 8. And then they acknowledge 6 again. That was probably 9. Yeah?
So why doesn't it send a packet 13 after ACK 5?
Why does it send packet 13 after ACK 5? We don't have information in the question. So my guess as to a reason in real life is that maybe we don't have the data from the application yet. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Okay, and to also talk about quiz question 3. So in quiz question 3, I think a thing a bunch of people missed is that our network configuration that's relevant to this question is machine A goes to switch S1, which goes to switch S2, which goes to switch C. And each of these connections is 10 milliseconds in each direction. So we have 30 milliseconds from A to C, 30 milliseconds from C to A. So our round trip time is around 60 milliseconds. And we send about one packet per millisecond maximum. So that means kind of our sort of at window size greater than 60, we start getting packet loss. And at window size less than 60, we should have no packet loss. Assuming no one else is using the network, that's the behavior we expect. And if we think about what happens over time, so this is time and this is window size, and we have our window size of 60. So what we're going to do is first we're going to have our slow start. So we're going to start from 1 and ramp up, and then we're going to have a packet loss, and we're going to go to about half. Then we're going to go up slowly, then we're going to go to about half, then we're going to go up slowly, and go to about half. And that's the behavior we expect to happen in this scenario. And we know that these peaks are, you know, just above 60. And, you know, at or just above 60. It might, you know, at because there's like little bursts maybe. And this is going to be sort of the max divided by 2. So we expected something close to 30 and 60, maybe like 61 and 31, something like that. But something around there is the behavior we'd expect. So questions on my reasoning for question 3? Yeah?
Just to confirm, are we ignoring the capacity for ACK-only packets because it's larger, so the data packet capacity is like limited?
So question, are we ignoring the capacity for echo-only packets because it's larger? Yeah, so it's so much larger that, you know, yeah, that we're clearly not even close to reaching the capacity for X. So if it were smaller, this could be a concern. And it's something that we've kind of ignored so far. I'm going to mention later, is that what happens when we have a slow backlink. And this, like, I guess it has been an issue, like, on consumer connections, because often you'll get, like, a connection with, like, gigabit down, 1 megabit up. That's the sort of connection where that could be a problem. But given this connection was so, had so much capacity for X, which is normal because X are small, you know, not, we're, you know, we could do the calculations, but we find out, you know, no X should be lost. Does that answer your question? Okay, other questions? Okay, so a logistical note. There's a VM that you need for the assignment due Friday, and I thought I had, you know, I had intended that people would realize from my warning before I left for travel that you need to make sure that this worked for you if you had a situation where running VMs was tricky, like using an M1, an ARM-based Mac. Evidently, I should have made a deadline where you had to submit a screenshot of a working VM, because some people did not do that. If you are in a situation where this is going to be hard, please, you know, figure out if this is going to be a problem for you as soon as possible and let me know if you're having issues. We might have some alternatives for some people, like there's some loaner laptops we can get if that's hard. I hope to have someone volunteer a VM image that we can share with people. I don't have a good way of making an ARM VM personally. Like, I can do it, but I can only run ARM VMs in emulation that's like 20 times slower than if you're running them natively. And the instructions we have involve compiling things that are not small. And you have...
I was just going to volunteer. I can make it.
Okay, so you can do that. Do you know about UVA Box?
UVA Box.
So if you go to virginitobox.com, we pay for cloud storage. Your quota, the quota for everyone is 1 terabyte. You can upload it there and share it.
Okay.
And not worry about, like, running out of space on Google Drive or anything. That'd be great. Yeah, and obviously one without the assignment done, but with the set of instructions done would be great and would save people time, since I know people have had issues with that. Yes, and in the future, I need to have a first deadline. I needed to have something to do the week before, which is like, show me a screenshot of the VM working and just submit that, you know, just to make sure it gets done, because people just didn't look at it. And it's like, not that it's hard, it's just that, like, it's things that take time to run that you know, you don't have to do work, but you have to wait for something to happen. Or we have to, like, get you a different machine or something. Yeah.
So on the P4 homework write-up, it says we should go to the tutorials /cs4457 subdirectory.
Yeah.
But in the actual image, I found that CS, like, the CS folder is inside of tutorials /exercises. Like,
oh, that is a typo in the assignment. You're correct. That is a typo in the assignment. I will correct that after lecture, hopefully. Thank you for writing that. Other questions? Yes. Yeah.
I don't know, they'll just, like, keep being sent sometimes, like, after, like, when I'm not running, like, any, when I'm not pinging anything, and, I'm just, like, confused as to, like, why that's happening.
Are they still sent from the wrong MAC addresses well after it sets up? Okay, that's interesting. I'm surprised by this. I mean, the easiest workaround would be to turn off IPv6.
Yeah.
Which maybe I should have done in that VM to keep things simple. Like, I'm not surprised they're queued up at the beginning, because my impression of how the system works is that basically it sets up a virtual network, then it changes its MAC addresses. So there might be packets queued up before that MAC address change.
Yeah, but they don't just, I don't know, they just keep like...
They just keep going, yeah.
So I
would still expect IPv6 autoconfig packets. I just expect them to come from the new MAC address. But that's not happening, apparently. Okay. I didn't run for long enough to notice it, I guess. I like ran for long enough to see the initial messages. But I didn't notice when I was testing the other ones. But I can believe it. Like, they're harmless. We can ignore them. They're not the things you're dealing with. We should still make MAC rules for them, because that's how MAC learning works, right? We see a source MAC address, we should add that to the table. But yes, I guess I didn't pay enough attention to the extra junk going on. I assumed that was only at the beginning and then it would stop. But I'm surprised not. But yeah, it's just, it's that we're writing a full Linux installation and it thinks this is a network interface and it wants to use IPv6 on it. So it's running the program to do that wherever the code is that this IPv6 autoconfig is just enabled. And the easy workaround would be to figure out how to find a, probably with the sysctl command to turn off IPv6 on the system. But I don't think it harms anything. It's just an annoyance in that you have things that annoy your debug output, which I assume is what you're annoyed by, understandably. Does that answer your question? Or yeah. But yeah, thanks for noticing that. That is confusing. Other assignment stuff? Okay. So let's go back to our mesh control. So we finished up slow start. So I can talk about this picture we saw earlier. So this is from a paper about a congestion control scheme we'll talk about later, but this is dealing with TCP Reno, which is a funny name for normal TCP. And you can see our slow start and this kind of sawtooth diagram we saw earlier. So this gray line here is the window size. The dotted line is the slow start threshold. So that's if we have a timeout, remember we reset the window size down to zero. It says, how far do we keep doing slow start? And they adjust that after each kind of normal congestion event halves the window size as a kind of a guess about where to stop doing slow start next time. So you can see we have our initial setup, our initial sort of quote unquote slow start, there exponential increase, and then we have this event where we just end up getting our window size down here, and we have this sort of sawtooth pattern that settles out as we do that. So, where was I? And look at some other examples. So, another way of visualizing this is, I'll do this example, is that, our sort of slow start, we kind of send a burst of one packet, then we receive that, we increase the window size by one, so we send two packets. Then we receive all the acks for these packets, and we send, so this is when the acks are sent, so when we receive the acks, we send eight packets, because we increased by one for each of the four. And then we have a packet loss, and eventually we retransmit it once we realize there's a packet loss, go up, and then our window size gets reduced. And we're sending at a slower rate, but we eventually settle at, especially since we kind of have these transmission delays, with a realistic connection, things get spread out more from this initial behavior of sending these big bursts. So we end up with hopefully this kind of line that's roughly our bandwidth. That's kind of what we hope the normal behavior of TCP is that we have this kind of steady transmission rate over time. Yeah?
In the previous trace graph, why is there always like a spike after we have the transmission window?
after we have the, why is there a spike here?
No, like for the previous graph.
This one?
The one before this, yeah.
Why is there a spike? I am not sure. I think this is an accounting error. I'm not sure. I have to read the paper carefully to find out.
For every single drop. Like there's...
Oh, the spike, that might be the adjustment for fast retracement. The adjustment for fast retransmit. Remember, we have this temporary increase to quickly resend do backs. I think that's part of that. This seems too high for that, so I'm not sure exactly. But there is that temporary adjustment for fast retransmit because we know we want to send from the end of the window to compensate for, we shouldn't actually have the window size. And that might be that sort of temporary adjustment that we know we want to send some new packets to keep the number in flight normal.
It just looks like the spike is even higher than like the original half window before.
So the spike is supposed to be higher than the half window, right? Because we're adding on to the half window when we do that adjustment.
Yes.
So it should end up being higher than the half window. It shouldn't be any really higher than the original window most likely, but...
I meant the original. Like, all the spikes seem like taller than the original window, if you look at it.
Okay, yes. Yeah, I think that, so I'm not sure. I could imagine that still working out for a fast retransmit because we might have a lot of packets that are kind of, we might have a lot of duplicates, a real lot, or a lot of cases where we're just not sending new, or we haven't acknowledged new data yet, and we can still have stuff we can send. I assume that's it. I haven't looked deeply into it, but I think it's from that sort of temporary window size adjustment for fast retransmits. Yeah, so here we have, so this is like our typical behavior, and the reason we get this kind of nice straight lines is that self-clocking idea, right? That once our acts kind of get naturally spread out, they stay spread out. You know, and that's sort of our normal behavior we hope for. And we can see here, this is Tahoe. This is without having the window size. This is resetting the window size to 1 out on a loss. And you can see, you know, and doing the, having, but having a slow start threshold. So that's kind of our slow start behavior. So one thing that was mentioned in a question about today about the quiz was, you know, what happens when acts are lost? That I've sort of talked about assuming all our congestions kind of on the forward path. But we can also have congestions with acts. And we hope that this is kind of rare because acts are really small. They should be really easy to transmit. But, you know, acts kind of are a special problem. And kind of one of the big issues is that a lot of the sort of cost of processing packets is per packet. It's not based on the packet size. And then sending an act for each packet means that we're actually imposing a lot of load on our switches and routers because they have to process so many packets. And often, you know, even though the link might have a very high capacity in terms of bandwidth, you won't achieve that capacity if you're sending only very small packets. That the switches and routers won't be able to keep up with what the link can do. And so one thing that was done for this is something called delayed acts. Is that rather than immediately acknowledging everything, we can deliberately not acknowledge each packet right away, with the goal being that we send one acknowledgement for multiple packets. You know, something like, you know, one acknowledgement every 2 packets. And if we're doing something like this scenario, where we're kind of having our acts sort of naturally get spread out anyways, this isn't going to affect our overall bandwidth very much. That, you know, you're going to receive half as many acknowledgments, but they'll acknowledge twice as much. So we'll send twice as much in response to each one. Remember, when we get an acknowledgment, we see how far does our window go now. We send every extra packet. So this is in fact something that most TCP implementations do these days. Not all of them, but most of them do these delayed acts where they deliberately sort of set a little timer and wait a little time after they receive some packets before acknowledging it, with the hope being that they can acknowledge a bunch of packets together and just have less load on the network. Now this does add some latency. So for this reason, like Linux, for example, lets you turn off for a particular socket delay acts. Because if you really care about latency, you might not want it. Because it is higher latency, it's deliberately adding time to the connection. Okay, so that's on the reverse path. So something we've kind of assumed with congestion control is that we've kind of looked at, okay, our link has a capacity, and our goal is to like meet that capacity. And there's kind of some theoretical reasons why that's actually not a good goal. And to talk about that, I'm going to talk about some queuing theory. So queuing theory is basically a branch of applied probability, or industrial engineering, or operations research. Depends who you talk to. But I'm going to show you sort of these probability results. We're not going to derive them, because probability isn't a prereq of this class, and it's not a great use of our time. But they have sort of studied queuing, sort of waiting in line systems, and like how those behave. And this is kind of from a probability perspective. And we'll see, like, we're going to assume that some things are basically random. And we're going to look at sort of what does that mean for how long queues are, how long things have to wait, and so on. And when we're talking about queues in this theoretical sense, we'll have, like, two kind of big measures. So one is the arrival rate. How often do we get, in our case, packets coming into our queue, or, you know, our switch or router that has a list of waiting packets. And our service time, that once we get something to the head of the queue and we start doing what it needs to do, in the case of a packet, sending it somewhere, how long does that take? And both of these are going to be kind of random variables in that sense that they're going to vary over time, that, you know, our packets aren't going to be evenly spaced, it's going to change. And our service time is not going to be even because we have different size packets. They take different amounts of time to process. So we're going to assume that both of these are, in the probability sense, random variables. But they have some sort of expected value, and we'll call kind of the ratio between them the utilization. And sort of one fundamental thing is that if things are arriving faster than we process them, things are broken. You know, we're never going to handle that situation. And we'll call how close we are to that our utilization. So 100% utilization means things are arriving exactly as fast as we can process them. And you might say, okay, 100% utilization, that's where I want to be, right? We're getting full use of our link. But it turns out that with sort of randomness that's inherent in things, and I don't mean like real randomness, but like just that like, our packets aren't exactly evenly spaced, right? There's a little bit of variation. It's not like from one rolling a die, but it's like from, you know, sometimes something takes a little longer on my system or my switch. The processing is different. Sometimes people press a key at slightly different times. So there are things that are effectively random. And because of that, we cannot run our system at 100%. Our system will do horrible, horrible things if we're at 100% utilization or very close to it. So to present sort of theoretical results in a specific context for that, we'll talk about what's called an MM1 infinity queue. So what are these things here? So the first number is our arrival distribution. And M stands for memoryless. And what this means is that if I know when the last packet arrived, that doesn't tell me anything about when the next one will. That basically at any time, the chance of me getting a new packet is the same. You can argue about whether this is or isn't realistic, but this is kind of the fewest assumptions I can make. If you've taken probability, this is equivalent to an exponential distribution for how long it is between packets arriving. But kind of the intuition is that if I look at the network at any time, the chance I see a packet is always the same. You know, so obviously that's not actually what happens. Obviously there's actual variation in what the chance is, but that's kind of our easiest guess. And I'll assume the same thing for the service time, that if I look at a packet, the chance that it takes, you know, 50 versus 100 is always the same no matter what, you know. And it's kind of, you know, and it's kind of just sort of, and the chance that if I've seen it take 50, if that's going to need another 50 is always the same. That's what this random service time means, is that sort of how long it takes, you know, doesn't depend on how long it's taken so far. You know, it always needs another n seconds with the same probability, or n microseconds most likely, right? And the one means that I have one place my packets can go. So I have one port going out that this queue is servicing. And the infinity means my queue has unlimited length. So obviously our queue does not have unlimited length. That's why we have packet loss. But often we're going to be thinking about, okay, I'm going to make my queue really big so I can get high utilization. In fact, that's something we'll need to do to get high utilization. And also, doing the sort of statistics is way, way easier if you assume infinite queue length. If you don't assume infinite queue length, you can do those calculations, but they get way more complicated. So this is kind of our theoretical model. So basically, we're kind of assuming as little as possible about when things arrive and how long they take. We're just like assuming that's kind of just random, you know, little as few assumptions as possible. And the queue length we get, so this is sort of the average length of our queue. And the average length of our queue has this shape, which should be familiar to you, in that this line keeps going up. So the closer we get to 100%, the larger our queue gets. Well, that's not surprising. But it gets exponentially larger. So operating our network at like 99% utilization is going to be really bad. We're going to have huge queues, even though we are below the capacity of the network. You have a whole 1%. We're going to have these huge, huge queues on average. And it's not because we couldn't like avoid that by carefully like having a packet come like every millisecond. You know, if our packet arrivals were not kind of random, if they were like very precisely timed, we could have a queue length of one. But that's not how our real networks work. So we're going to get this explosion in queue length. And this means that if you're designing a network, you should never design a network to operate in this range. Like, that's just not going to work. You have to provide extra capacity, or else your performance is just going to be totally unacceptable. And it kind of gets worse. So this is the queue average, this is the mean queue length. But kind of what's happening here is that we kind of have these random cases where our packets are a little more bunched together than average, that kind of fills our queue. And this means that our standard deviation, sort of our variability of the queue length, also increases this way. So not only is our mean high, but kind of our variation between the best and worst case is very high. And that means that kind of our sort of, if we think about what happens like and when it gets bad, it's going to get super, super bad, like worse than, much, much worse than the average would suggest. So like kind of our 95th percentile length, you know, even when we're in the kind of, you know, it's already spiking when we're in the kind of 70, 80% range. And so, yeah, so I'm mentioning these results not because we want to like know the probability theory, but the big intuition to get is that like we have this massive increase in latency when we get close to 100% utilization. And here, I'm assuming an infinitely long queue. What's really going to happen is we're going to have a massive increase in packet loss, because our queue isn't infinitely long. We're going to cut this off. And so we won't be able to actually use that full capacity of our network. Even with a pretty long queue, we won't be able to, because we'll exhaust the capacity of that pretty long queue. And this means when you're designing networks, you need to have extra capacity. Like, you just can't say, I need to send 10 megabytes a second, let's have a 10 megabyte a second link. That does not work. You know, even if you account for, but I forgot that TCP headers take a little extra space, you can account for all that and it's still wrong because of this phenomenon where queues kind of fill up because things get bunched together a little bit. And it just kind of quickly becomes a disaster when you try to even get up to like 90% of the theoretical capacity. Okay, so questions on our brief foray into queuing theory? So I'm just showing the results here, the sort of formulas. If you can look up the distributions of that, look up the derivations of them. Like, there's something you should be able to actually do if you remember probability, but they're not especially interesting to do the derivations. So something that this brings up is that when we're kind of fully utilizing a link, which scarily is what AIMD tries to do, we're filling up these buffers. We're going to have really full buffers. And maybe a better picture of that diagram I showed you earlier is that, you know, we're kind of really adjusting not the bandwidth, but the window size. You know, I guess the bandwidth and the window size. And when we're at this sort of high utilization, our buffers are all almost full. That's just kind of the natural state that the congestion control algorithms we've seen so far get us into. And this is a concern because of, you know, buffers adding latency. And there was a period where people were not really paying attention to this, and we had this problem, particularly on consumer connections, where we had this kind of big mismatch in bandwidth between people's broadband connections and their home network, where home routers would often have pretty big buffers. So here's a study from 2011, which kind of tries to figure out how big the buffers were on people's connections versus their bandwidth going outside. So people had low upstream bandwidth from their home to the internet, but they had routers on them which had relatively big buffers. And by relatively big, I mean that, let's figure out which line is which here. So this black line is, so this black line here. So if we think here, that's 256. And so this black line here, that's kilobytes. So this is kilobytes. So this is 256 kilobytes. That's 1 megabyte. So here, that black line means that the buffer holds 2 whole seconds of packets. So a bunch of people have connections where when the buffer gets full, it adds 2 seconds to your latency, which is pretty horrible. And even the less bad cases are like 1/2 second, 1/4 second. We're adding a ton of latency. So if we care about bandwidth, not so bad. But, you know, this much latency is pretty bad for some applications. If you want, like if you have a remote desktop, a 1 second delay from your mouse click to anything happening is pretty bad. And this is what normal consumer routers were doing. And this problem was known as buffer bloat, and still is known as buffer bloat. So I don't know of like super recent studies on buffer bloat. I gather there's been a lot of mitigations deployed. In particular, there's things we can do in routers to make this less bad. There's in fact a very obvious one, which is don't have huge buffers on your routers. Like, this is a good reason not to make your buffer really huge. There's some more subtle things you can do as far as how we manage those buffers that we're going to talk about as our next topic that can also help. But at the time, that's not what was happening in consumer routers. The typical router people had just had like, you know, a megabyte of buffer for the slow connection going up. And now we add a ton of latency to everything. And it's also probably not great for our congestion control, because even if we aren't doing that remote desktop application, having a 1 second round trip time means that our minimum time to adjust our bandwidth downwards is 1 second. And our minimum sort of our additive increase is going to be also very slow. So it just makes sort of very bad network performance. So there's kind of two fixes you can use here. So the simplest one is just do smaller buffers. Don't have big buffers. Having big buffers, like, it sounds like a good idea, but if you just do that, you actually make your network perform worse a lot of the time, unless you take some other measures. But there are some other things we can think about doing that will mitigate this. So one of these is we can choose which packets to drop better. And the other is we can, you know, choose something other than drops as our congestion signal to avoid filling buffers. So the second one seems like a nice idea in theory. It's not really deployed, and that's because we're going to talk about some ways of doing this. They work. They don't really work as well as drop-based congestion control in practice for most people. But they're worth talking about because they're interesting ideas that are functional and probably our best congestion control would combine them with sort of what we've seen before. And we'll talk later as kind of a next topic about how do we choose when to drop packets in a better way, and that's going to let us actually avoid filling buffers but still have many of the benefits of big buffers. Like the big advantage of having big buffers is we have less packet loss. And that's going to make our connections sort of perform more smoothly. You know, we're going to have less times when we need to have them sort of spuriously drop packets, even though they're not exceeding the bandwidth they should use, and things like that. Okay, so before we get on to sort of those mitigations, we're going to talk a bit about another consequence of this kind of massive increase in sort of queue size and variation in queue size. And this is probably the big reason why, if we look at the things in Jacobson's paper, we've gone through slow start, we've gone through dynamic window sizing, you mentioned fast retransmit, and we'll talk briefly about this and this. So one thing they did is they tried to estimate the variance of round trip times. And this idea about kind of this kind of explosion in queue size and that high variation in queue size explains why this became a problem. That when we have these big queues that can hold several, you know, many, a large portion of our time, round trip time in packets, that means that suddenly, you know, estimating the highest round trip time, you know, is not as simple as just measuring, because it's going to vary a huge amount based on how full the queues are. In fact, you know, it's going to, you know, vary enough that our original heuristic, and probably the one most of you used in reliable part one, of twice the round trip time stops working very well. So as an example, let's say I have a 1 millisecond round transmission delay and a 20 millisecond propagation delay and a queue depth between 1 and 10 packets. What is my round trip time range? Someone, actual calculations. So how about, what if we have no queue? What is our round trip time in this case? Anyone? So if I have no queue, so I have my source, a destination, and to transmit, it needs to spend 20 milliseconds on this wire, and we need 1 millisecond to place it on there, right? We have a 1 millisecond to transmit it, 20 milliseconds for it to go across the wire. So we have 20 ms without the queue per direction. So we have 42 milliseconds without queue. Then we have to add the queuing time. And basically, if there's queuing, we have to wait in line for other packets to be transmitted. So we have plus 1 ms if 1 ahead in queue, and plus 10 ms if 10 ahead in queue. So basically, the more packets ahead of us, for each one we have to wait one its transmission time. And so this gives us a 43 to 52 ms. So this is a case where that 2 times round trip time works fine, right? 2 times the round trip time we measure is going to be 80 to 100 milliseconds. We're never going to mess up here. But the reason they had problems is that their queues were getting very full and they were probably relatively big compared to their bandwidth. So let's take this scenario here. We have the same thing, but not the same thing. We have a shorter propagation delay, so we have a shorter link. And we have a queue depth that's 10 to 40 packets. So I have 12 milliseconds without a queue plus 10 to 40 times 2, so 24 ms plus 10 to 40 ms. So that's going to be 34 to 74 milliseconds time. Yeah.
Why is it
12? It's not 12, sorry. It's 11 without queuing. You're correct. Sorry. I don't know. I am reading things that are on slides that are wrong. 22. So 32 to 72. And in this case, if we have an estimate on the lower end, we're going to have these timeouts that are fake timeouts. We're going to trigger timeouts when, you know, the packet actually got there. And in particular, a way this could be worse in practice is that often what will happen is someone else will transmit a whole bunch of packets and that will suddenly increase our round trip time. Right? That will usually be measuring in the 10 range, and then someone else sends a whole bunch of packets all at once and that increases it temporarily to like 40 queue depth, and we're just going to time out everything even though it's just a temporary delay. So what they did instead is they said, we're going to compute a moving average, not just of the average round trip time, sorry. We're going to also compute a moving average of the variation, the deviation of the difference from the average of the round trip time, and add that into our timeout calculation. Instead of doing this multiply by 2, we're going to have this estimated variation as a factor there. And this necessity, you can see from our queuing theory argument that the sort of variance in that queue depth gets really high. So it's actually very important to account for it for that reason. But just looking at the average, even if we have the correct average, is not going to, multiplying by two stops working when we get to that high utilization area. So the other thing they talk about is this exponential backoff. And I don't think exponential backoff was super important for TCP, but it's worth talking about because this idea comes up a bunch of other places in networking. And it was kind of a nice strategy that, you know, is useful in general. And the motivation for this is that if we think of the normal timeout behavior, we computed the timeout, that's great. And let's say our network's performing really poorly, and we have lots of timeouts. We're going to transmit at one, if our timeout's one time unit, we're going to transmit at 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 time units. And maybe the reason our network is performing poorly is that everyone's doing this. That we just have so many people transmitting every time unit that it overloads the network, just doing these retransmissions from a timeout. And we need some way of making them stop. How do we make them stop? Well, the solution that they came up with is this exponential backoff idea. So a version of that is that basically each time we retransmit a second time, we don't use the same timeout, we always increase our timeout in an exponential way. The idea being that as time goes on, we're kind of halving the load on the network each time. So if our network was overloaded from everyone retransmitting, that will stop happening because everyone's kind of halving their demand, hopefully. You know, and eventually we'll settle out to something the network can actually handle. And so what this looks like is that we kind of retransmit one, then, you know, here I'm doing +2, +4, +8, and kind of increasing how much I wait each time, because my assumption is the network is probably overloaded. Let's not make it worse. We still want to make progress, but let's slow down more and more and more until the network can handle it. So questions about this backoff idea? So this is sort of, so they did this, what's called binary backoff, exponential backoff, because you can, our timeout is like 2 to the i, so twice, then 4 times, then 8 times the original timeout. And I can't spell on these slides. And for some of these cases using exponential backoff, there's this nice theoretical result which says that this actually like works in general. This doesn't exist for TCP. In fact, you know, you can come up with cases pretty easily where if you have lots of people making connections, it's still overloaded and it's hard to bound it. But there's some famous results that we will probably talk about later when we talk about like wireless networking, which uses the same strategy. So we see the strategy in congestion control, we'll see it again in wireless networks, where we have the same issue, right? That if everyone's retransmitting all the time, we're going to overload the wireless network, and this is the same strategy they use there. Okay, so that's where I'm going to finish talking about sort of our normal TCP congestion control. So we're just going to talk about some names, because you might see these names. So basically, there's places where they had conferences, and that's what they named TCP variants after. So we have TCP Tahoe, kind of implemented these sort of first set of changes, but not the sort of actual, not the setting the window, they submitted TCP Tahoe set the window size to like 1 instead of having it. So Reno does the having the window size on the duplicate ACK. New Reno added fast recovery, And sometimes you'll see SAC referred to, which is new renal plus selective acknowledgments instead of, you know, only acknowledging the sort of last thing. And there are a whole bunch of TCP schemes. I could like make 10 slides of them. I have some more recent ones that are notable. So we mentioned CUBIC. So CUBIC is actually derived from something called BIC. And these are loss-based schemes where basically they tweak the increase-decrease algorithm, and usually with the goal of handling high bandwidth connections better, because in the 80s, 90s, they didn't have many high bandwidth connections, and TCP didn't handle them well. There's also going to be our kind of next little topic is that there's a bunch of schemes that use latency or bandwidth instead of losses to detect congestion. So we'll talk briefly about that. There's a bunch of schemes like that. So that's going to be our next topic. So let's talk about like what can we do to get sort of how can we make something work where we don't use packet loss? And one of the motivations for not using packet loss is that packet loss is a very coarse signal, right? We're kind of already in a bad place when packet loss happens. We only get a few packet losses, so we have to react really aggressively to it. And there's this idea that if we could get a better signal that something is going on with the network, we could react sooner, we could react in a way that's tailored for how bad the network actually is, which we can't really do with loss-based congestion, right? Now we're just looking at losing an ACK. We kind of have to act aggressively because we don't get many losses, actually. And we have to, and it's already too late. We have to really decrease fast. So there's going to be kind of two ideas that are going to let us implement congestion control without losses. So one of them is going to have some cooperation from the network. And that's we're going to have switches and routers, rather than dropping packets, they're going to give us a warning that, hey, this is pretty close to being dropped. Maybe you should slow down. And we'll do what's called marking packets. Another idea we can have is that we can look at the queue length. That I mentioned that when we have these long queues, our round trip time goes up. We can use that to infer that, oh, I must be getting close to having packet loss. Let me slow down first. Or we can also infer, oh, my latency isn't increasing very much. I must be far away from having packet loss. I can increase faster and it's going to be safe. So let's talk about the marking packets idea. And this is called explicit congestion notification. And basically the idea is that before the buffer gets completely full, we'll just take some of the packets that are almost about to be dropped, and we'll set a signal on them, and this will allow us to figure out that, your packet was about to be lost, you should slow down. And we can do this before we actually get packet loss. So we can do our congestion control kind of sawtooth pattern, but without ever having to retransmit anything. And you might say, well, we talked about the end-to-end principle, and like if we relied on this to have the right sending rate, this would violate the end-to-end principle. But we can still fall back to having packet drops. Right, we can still react to packet loss. We can use this kind of as an optimization to react more nimbly and without sending extra stuff in most cases. But when the network doesn't handle that functionality for us, it's fine. We still have all our loss-based congestion control to fall back on. And this is a thing that's actually implemented in IP and actually available on the real internet. And there's this congestion experienced sort of signal, this flag, in the IP header. So when we're sending a packet from A to B, a router might set this congestion experience bit in the IP header, or this actual field. And when we acknowledge a packet, we check that bit before we acknowledge it. And if we're acknowledging something where congestion was experienced, when we acknowledge it, we don't just send back a normal acknowledgement. We add this flag to the acknowledgement that is called the ECN echo flag. So basically, you know, the receiver is getting the information about whether the congestion happened. And we have to explicitly send that to the sender. So normally the way this happens is we lose a packet and the sender figures out there was congestion because it doesn't get the ACKS it expects. But in the case of this ECN, we're still gonna get the ACKS we expect, so we need to modify those ACKS to say, hey, I noticed this bit was sent on the packet you had, which told me that it was almost dropped. Watch out. And we have to worry about what happens if the acknowledgement that has this bit set saying that there was congestion gets lost. So the solution TCP has for this is that this ECN echo flag is sent on every acknowledgement until the sender sets the congestion window reduced flag. So basically the idea is we keep saying, you know, haven't gotten it, you keep saying, hey, there was a mark that your packet was almost dropped. We just keep saying that until the sender sends back, yep, got that, and I reduced my window. But this is to handle, you know, what happens if those ACKS get lost. Our solution is we just keep telling the sender, hey, something happened, until they acknowledge it. Question, yeah.
So what if there are like two connections and whether simultaneously sending stuff, one of the connection is saying that the messages are all getting dropped, but then before the sender react to it, like by having a window or something like that, the other connection stopped. So there's actually room again. Would it still like send this ECE flag?
So the question is, what happens if we experience congestion, but before we can respond to it, you know, the congestion goes away? Will we still do the reduction? Yes. And that's the same thing that would happen with our normal drops too, right? We'd still lose a packet and we'd still have our window, even if by the time we get the ACKS back, there's enough capacity now. We just can't react. We just don't react on timescales that are much smaller than our round trip time in general. Because all our ways of finding out that congestion occurs that we've seen so far, like, rely on messages getting from sender to receiver to sender. So inherently, that's as fast as we can react. If our network changes faster than that, we're going to be behind. So I could imagine designs where we react faster, but this involves having our switches or routers, like, communicate directly to the sender somehow.
I was just imagining if the sender received the signal and then doesn't immediately change the window size.
Question, if the sender receives the window, doesn't immediately change the window size? So generally, if you're implementing this policy, you'll immediately change the window size, or at least pretend you are, and tell the receiver, hey, I changed the window size. So it stops sending you the bit. Does that answer your question? Yeah, so like this is called congestion window reduced. This is like maybe a better name might be ECE acknowledge. Like that's the real purpose of that bit. Does that answer your question? It's really there just to acknowledge that, yes, I got this. It's not there to actually say exactly what you did in response to it. Okay, so I mentioned that this is a feature of IP and it's opt-in. And it's opt-in in that there's this two bits in the IP header where when you're sending packets, if you put zeros in them, you're saying, I don't support this congestion notification thing. You have to drop my packets for me to do anything about them. And if you put a one or a two in there, it says, I support this congestion notification, please mark this packet if it would almost be lost. And then the switch or router is going to set that to 1-1 if it actually thinks your packet was almost lost. So kind of the way this works is, you know, that will receive, will send packets, and as they go through the network, the packet will actually be changed by the switches or routers to set this flip, and will echo that back. And not shown here is we'll have, you know, the acknowledgement signal sent back, so we don't keep echoing it. Okay. So questions on our ECN marks? And yeah.
So it's marking the ECN, like the zero packet, like it'll send the second one, and only the second one will get marked ECN.
Only the second one? Oh, sorry, I messed up this slide. This should be the one packet. We aren't changing it back to the first packet and then ignoring that. So, zero the two. That's just a copy paste error. But yeah, so the intention is that each packet that goes through the switch can potentially be marked. And then we'll send back with our ACKs that, hey, I got this packet back, and also I saw this ECN signal. You should do something about that. And then this sender will send back, yep, I saw that. You got that ECN signal. You don't need to tell me about it anymore. And in this scenario, we aren't adjusting the window size apparently, probably because 2 is like the smallest we'll ever go. But kind of in practice, typically what TCP implementations will do is they'll make the same window size adjustments they would if a packet was dropped, except they don't need to retransmit the thing that would have been dropped. So this is kind of mostly better. And also, very often, switches that implement this might, if the packet doesn't support ECN and they would mark it, they'll instead drop it. So you have no incentive not to set the ECN enable flag in sort of the typical configuration. And so this seems like this is a good idea that should improve our network performance. So you think everyone would use it. And it has the problem of something that was deployed on the internet after the internet had been around for a while. So ECN was proposed in 2001. And getting things adopted by the internet is real slow. So about 13 years later, about 56% of websites supported it. So basically, people used the Alexa list for a web crawl of like a million websites and checked how many of them actually support it. 56%. 16 years later, about 80%, but disturbingly, they also found that 0.2%, not many, but some percentage of servers, like if you set the ECN enable bit, your connection just doesn't work. Just doesn't work. And more recently, so in 2021, it's 86%, so 20 years we have still 14% of people not doing it. Also, some 4% of paths, so 4% of like connections they observed, you know, strip ECN signals, meaning that you can say ECN enable and they'll just set it to zero. And this included some prominent ISPs, like major mobile providers and cloud providers would do this. And only about sort of 70.5% of actual connections made by normal clients use this feature, even though it seems like a no-brainer to turn on and improve your performance. And that's the world of deploying things on the internet. Yeah, a lot of things end up moving slowly, in this case especially because it involves all the switches and routers kind of buying in enough. So that's where I'll finish up today. So next time we'll talk, we'll finish up talking about the other type of congestion signal briefly, and then look at managing queues, including like how do we decide when to mark and drop things in queues intelligently.